I'd like to introduce Jim Almendinger. So, sort of following on this same broad theme, Jim will be sharing his experience and his approach to communicating science. Jim received a BA in botany and a PhD in ecology. After postdoctoral work in Alaska and Sweden, he's well acquainted with colder climes. He spent 5 years as a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He's now the director of the Science Museum of Minnesota's St. Croix Watershed Research Station, where he's spent over 20 years doing hydrological research to better understand human impacts of the environment at the watershed scale.
Well, good to be here. Pinch hitting for a few minutes here. This group I'd like to remind, I want to step back and just calm down and remind you that when you think of the really important things in life, these are faith, hope, love, charity, all the really important things in life, these are things you cannot see. And it might be a stretch to add groundwater to that list, but you know, groundwater is something that's really important and you can't see it. And so this group really ought to appreciate it. If I had five kids, I'd name them faith, hope, love, and charity, and groundwater. That last kid would have trouble in school, I'm pretty sure, and he gets teased about his name, but well, it'll make him tougher. I'm going to talk to you today about how to tell your parents about your groundwater problem. I know it's embarrassing. It's like you wrecked your car and you're afraid to tell your parents, or you got a D- in typing. But it's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about how do you tell a non-technical audience about a technical subject. And that's the goal here. I want to remind people that if I click right there, yeah. Where I come from is the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. We are the Environmental Research Department of the Science Museum of Minnesota. And we are a private nonprofit laboratory, not a state agency. So we're dependent on getting government grants and contracts in order to exist and to function. We're a small team of independent-minded scientists. There are five PhDs out there. And we are dedicated to doing the science that makes our rivers and lakes cleaner and our aquifers as well. So we don't forget about that. We do the whole water cycle. Typical science communication is this. How many people know what this stands for? How many people have written a scientific paper? It is introduction, methods, research and discussion, and summary. This is very, 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 it's used all the time. That's the formula. It is passionless, it should be. I mean, just a fun fact, it started in the 1600s. It needs to be comprehensive for reproducibility, and it's scoured clean of anything unnecessary. And yet, and as important as reports are and papers, I will tell you that if you really want people to understand and read your work, you need to write a fact sheet. That really is very, very helpful. I'll try to touch on that again. But anyway, this IMRAD's method is definitely coloring inside the lines. You don't want to step outside that, or your reviewers will cut you off. Typical science communication is a formality that's carried into our presentations. You know, we're told to tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them. And you use this, and we did this, and that, and so forth. And then you summarize by telling them what you told them. This AAA structure of and this, and that is really boring. It's like giving somebody a spoonful of dry oatmeal and saying, here it is, and here's another spoonful of dry oatmeal. And to top it off, I'm going to give you a third spoonful of dry oatmeal. You can kind of choke it down. It's edible, but it's really kind of tough. At that stage, I'm going to skip the presentation and go read the abstract. Our formality is a security blanket. We keep science sort of on an ivory tower or a pedestal, and we hand down pronouncements from on high. And we use really arcane methods that nobody else understands. And that means if you don't understand my project, I feel smarter than you by comparison. And I can make sure you don't understand my project by giving a really bad presentation. So this is a formula for giving awful presentations because it makes us feel secure. And you can also show lots of graphs. I'll let this sink in for just a second. And I want to make sure, as the data clearly show, you can always say that. Or is there anyone who doesn't think this is clear? Yeah, raise your hand. Okay. Of course, nobody raises their hand. They don't want to look stupid. Science is a little too pretentious. You know, formality is fine for written publications. Although I do have trouble sometimes containing myself. I wrote a report about. doing watershed modeling across the upper Midwest, and I was looking at management practices, one of which was cultivation practices in the upper Midwest, and there's something called a cultipacker, which people use all across the upper Midwest. And I said it's widely used, But especially in Wisconsin, there are a lot of Packer fans. And I only got one comment back on that report that I wrote about that. And what that means is that nobody reads my reports. And I don't know about you, but that's what happens to me. And that's why I go back to say, you know, if you want people to read your reports or understand what you did, summarize them in a fact sheet that reaches a way wider audience. It's an important thing to do. But for presentations, we're speaking face-to-face. We're talking to each other. It's a personal communication. This is something that we have been hardwired to do ever since we lived in caves, got around fires, and wore fur miniskirts. So this is something that was really, I think, part of what human communication is all about, face-to-face presentations. You can say, well, I can't explain what I do. It's just too hard. You know, I'm really smart and the public isn't. I can't explain this stuff. And that's a bunch of baloney. And that's the international symbol for baloney. So if you're driving in Hungary or Estonia where the language is really difficult and you see this sign, you know it means no more baloney. Mortimer Adler says, the person who says he knows what he thinks but cannot express it usually does not know what he thinks. And I think that's true. Mortimer is kind of a stuffy guy, but he's really, I think, very bright. Wrote a book called How to Read a Book. And the endorsement says, from reading How to Read a Book, I have actually learned how to read a book. And another one called Aristotle for Everybody. Put that on your Christmas list. Difficult Thought Made Easy. I think he's probably pretty good at that. I think he's really a very good author. So this is what Feynman says about understanding. Richard Feynman, the famous physicist. His method for really understanding a topic was to identify a topic. For example, groundwater recharge. He probably didn't pick that one, but we would. Pretend to explain it in simple terms to a non-technical audience, a new student, or to your kindly parents. Then identify the sticking points in that presentation and go back and fix those. And by the time, and organize and simplify, and then add some analogy and humor. Here's an example of Feynman's humor. This is science is just imagination in a straitjacket. I had a professor who defined science as the painful elaboration of the obvious, but they're kind of very similar. Anyway, I think this is the critical point. If you want to explain a difficult topic, make sure that your mother or your father or your kids or a new student can understand it. You can really break it down into simple steps. It's easier said than done, I realize. And I think this second one, to organize and simplify and use analogy is important, to tie it to something people already know. The key point here is that understanding your issue and communicating about it, they're tightly linked. If you can't communicate it, it kind of means you really don't understand it. It's not a waste of time to try to communicate to people in a non-technical way, because it will help you understand it. These two main points can be brought together by telling a story about science. And how do you do that? How do you tell a story? Well, that means going all the way back to Joseph Campbell and his theories about the hero of a thousand faces. These are the archetypal hero journey stories that really are nearly all interesting stories follow this narrative. Narrative and story are more or less synonymous. This is picked up by Randy Olson, who's a former science researcher, then turned scriptwriter, who has written a book called Houston, We Have a Narrative. It's about trying to teach scientists to do better presentations and communicate their science in a more understandable way. But he basically takes the Joseph Campbell storyline or archetype and puts that onto science. And this is the universal narrative structure. You start out with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You have rising action to reach that middle. You have a climax that you reach. And then you have falling action and summaries down there to the end. Of course, this is a graph. Let's put some axis on it. There's time across the bottom and action on the left. And you start out in the ordinary world, then a problem arises. It pushes you into a special world. Excuse me. And then you have some sort of resolution and brings you back down to the end, and you finalize the story, and everybody lives happily ever after. Classical music follows the same pattern. You create tension and release it with major and minor keys and such. Is there anybody who does not think this is clear? Just to check. Okay. So an example, the Odyssey would be a story of this. The Trojan War ends. Odysseus and his crew get in boats. They escape a Cyclops. He hangs out with Calypso for a couple years. I'm pretty sure that would be my climax of the story. He escapes Scylla and Charybdis. They land back home, and in his ordinary world, he pulls out his bow and arrow and kills all the suitors around Penelope's bedroom door. I don't know why that's the ordinary world. That's pretty outstanding. And then he reconnects with Penelope. One of the best examples is The Wizard of Oz. You know, Dorothy starts out in Kansas, and then this tornado causes a problem. She lands in Oz. kills the witch, figures out how to get home, and they all reconcile in the end, even Toto. So it really is a very classic storyline, going from an ordinary to an extraordinary world and back to the ordinary world. You all know the Star Wars trilogy, you know, the original ones here, where, of course, Luke is just hanging out on Tatooine looking at the sunsets, I guess, plural. All of a sudden, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi and Princess Leia enlist his help, and he gets drawn into this special world that he has to go fight things where the bad people create these Death Stars and the good people blow them up, and then finally Han Solo saves Luke from that really creepy thing he had going on with his sister. I don't know what that was all about. And in the end, you know, R2-D2 and C-3PO settle down together, and they raise Ewoks on a fur farm. You guys remember that, right? They finally found good use for the Ewoks. It was okay. Well, so how do we fit science into this structure? And that's a bit of a trick. I mean, as I say, it is easier said than done. There are some types of science that fit in it great. One would be the expedition type field work, where you start out and you go. We had a trip to Mongolia 15 years ago now, and we got to plan for it, and we got to, you know, pack, do all the logistics, and we went and we got to see camels, and we got to canoe on really cool lakes and take sediment cores from other mountain lakes. It was really a great trip, and we came home and got cleaned up in Ulaanbaatar, and that was, you know, this sort of expeditionary type storyline easily follows the narrative structure. So in general, anytime you have a fieldwork-centric project, you can kind of tell a storyline that way, where you have a background and problem statement, and you prepare for the field. You do the field work, you show pictures of cool things, maybe problems or unexpected events crop up, creating some tension. And then you get back to the lab and you can summarize the results and conclusions and inform people the next steps, where you're going next. The hard part is when you have more ordinary science, it isn't an expeditionary type of story. You know, and this is where Randy Olson comes in with his Houston, We Have a Narrative book. He says you need to use this structure, an ABT structure, instead of the and that I presented early on. This is and, then but, oh, there's a tension point here that I have to think about. And therefore in the end. And that key tension point, I think, is that's the hard part you got to figure out. How do you weave that into a storyline when you tell a story about science? I would modify this a little bit. I would move the but down here to that point, which gives it that's right where you leave the ordinary world and enter the special world. And then you have the therefore up at the top. You finally reach a climax and you figure something out. And then you have falling action to a summary conclusion. So I think that's, to my mind, that's the way I would try to fit story into science. And I think this part should be relatively easy. The part where you once you figure something out, then you tell the story about what the answers are. And you can act smart to your audience because you know the answers and you're telling them the results. The hard part really is this here. How do you create the tension point that elicits people's interest in what you're doing and keeps them kind of on the edge of their seats waiting for you to tell them the therefore part? You can also add an initial hook to get people started. And I think that's always important. That gets them from the first sentence. That kind of is an example of the problem you're trying to solve is oftentimes a good entry point. Example tension points in science, and this is a boring word slide. I'm sorry about that. So I add a picture to make it not a word slide. A problem statement is, that's the very first one, potential building a tension point is that, how do we solve this problem? We've got a problem. How do we get around it? What can we possibly do? Multiple working hypotheses is part of this as well. If you don't know T.C. Chamberlain's 1890 or 91 paper on this, all scientists should know this. The point is, anytime you have a problem in science, you need to not have not just one hypothesis, but more than one hypothesis, multiple working hypotheses. Because if you only have one hypothesis and you get attached to it like a child and you defend it irrationally, you want two or three hypotheses so you do not have favored children out there. You have an array of rational choices and you need to pick among the best of those. And the literature will give you some of these hypotheses. That's one reason you're doing the project. And you can add several more yourself. And then in the end, you want to be able to distinguish among those. So which hypothesis is going to win? That's the tension point. Which of these is the best hypothesis? And then your project, your presentation will winnow out the good from the bad in that case. And then you may have methodological problems or concern that along the way you tried different things, the recipe didn't work, we had these issues, we had to fix them. And I think your audience can relate to that along the way, that we all have had problems doing our work. I don't want to go down too much down a false channel that won't lead anybody. But if it's a lesson to be learned about doing a project and solving a problem along the way, then explain that lesson to the people. They'll be interested in it. Excuse me. Other references I looked at along the way. This is a good book, too, if you want to get advice about giving talks. The Advice About TED Talks by Chris Anderson. Start with the curiosity, find a solution to a riddle, and then present it artfully. And try to have a through line to your story, a thread of thought that runs through all your presentation. Another reasonably good book is this one by Max Atkinson. This guy wrote political speeches for British politicians, so it's a little bit over the top at times. He's big on rhetorical devices, but he especially likes chalk and talk, where, like I'm doing here, I don't put up there what I'm going to say until I actually am going to say it. If you put things up there ahead of time, people will start reading them and not pay attention to you. I don't know how many people had Otto Strauch as a teacher. I mean, Otto was tremendous at chalk and talk. He would write things out on the board and drive them. He still does. I mean, really was one of the best teachers I ever had, and very inspiring that way. That's a fine example of how to do this. And that's a good technique. And you can do it in PowerPoint, just like I'm doing now, by only bringing up the points as you talk about them. They both give practical advice about speaking in front of people, which is good. I think I was supposed to mention a little bit about uncertainty in the public here. To the public's mind, uncertainty, especially when you have spin doctors taking uncertainty, they pretend that uncertainty really is the same thing as ignorance. That if you're not absolutely certain about what you're talking about, they can spin that and make it sound like you don't know what you're talking about at all. And that's a problem. To a scientist, of course, uncertainty is not ignorance. It is a measure of what we know. It's the variability about the possible results. So to a scientist, we would look at this and say, uncertainty is a measure of the precision of our knowledge. And if you want to use a better term than uncertainty, you could use precision of knowledge. That might help the public understand what we're talking about here. I realize there's an inverse relationship there. The higher the uncertainty, the lower the precision, and the lower the uncertainty, the higher the precision. So I could have put a negative one exponent on that, but I thought that would be too complicated. Another very good book, if you want to talk about dealing with science and public perception of science, is a book by Jonathan Haidt. It's called Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, and I would add, and Science. He has three main points in this book, and that is the first point is that the mind of all people out there, the public, is divided. It's like a rider, which is the reason, sitting on an elephant, and the elephant is in motion. And believe it or not, the rider's job is to justify what the elephant's doing. People use their intellect to justify their emotions more than use their intellect to guide their emotions. And if you want to change somebody's mind, you have to talk to their elephant. You have to change their emotions. Emotions are driven by moral foundations. They follow these pairs here: care versus harm, fairness versus cheating, loyalty versus betrayal. He identified six of these points. These are the ways you push people's emotions around. And political parties are very good at using these triggers to push your emotions around in order to get you to vote the way they want. And he says people in general are 90% selfish primate, chimps, and 10% unselfish bees contributing to the hive. 10% of you is a good citizen who really does want to be part of something larger and better than themselves. And if you want to, herein I think lies the hope of humanity. You need to appeal to people's better sense. They're better angels. People have a better angel. You just need to find what it is and appeal to that. Use your emotional buttons to push it that way. So if you want to, one thing is don't lay blame. We all accept responsibility for things. I think that's a very important step. Blaming people for things they had no intention of doing has caused enormous pushback and vicious backlash, I'd say. We've talked about people who, you know, we're causing climate change by driving big cars, and people didn't mean to cause climate change by buying big cars. So they push back and say, well, the heck with you, I'm going to buy a Hummer now, because you made me mad. And you try to talk to, you know, people about the non-point source pollution problems in agricultural areas, and you can't blame farmers for growing what they're growing, because they're growing what we pay them to grow them. They didn't create the markets. And so they push back, and they don't want to be blamed for the water quality problems that we pay them to create. We need to change policy if we want them to grow different things. So, and it's just not productive to blame people for things that they had no intention of causing. We have to find different terminology to get around that. And you can push, you know, facts alone will not change mind. You have to talk to their elephants. So encourage that 10% good citizen by appealing to their emotional buttons that were responsible. Use fairness. you don't want to, you know, ruin the pollution is violating the sanctity of nature and the authority of the government, and we're harming the environment, betraying, you know, our offspring and forefathers. I don't know. You can try to put these things together in a way that appeals to people's emotional triggers, and you might have better success than just saying it's their fault. To summarize things here, I'll tidy things up. Create your science story using the ABT structure, and but therefore, and seek out natural tension points that science gives to you. Like I say, that's easier said than done. It takes practice, but you can work at it. Simplify the story as best you can to make sure a non-technical audience can understand it. Pretend you're explaining it to somebody, like you're a new student or your parents. Use analogy and humor. Remember, uncertainty is not stupidity. It's the precision of our knowledge. And change somebody's mind. You have to talk to the relevant. You have to talk to their emotion and try to appeal to their better angel. So with that, I'll take questions if there are any. Are you done yet? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it can being concise and clear is very important. I agree. My minister said one time, he said, I wrote this great sermon. Really great. And I went down and told my wife about it. That's just a great sermon. He says, it might be a little long. And then his wife says, not looking up from the paper, says, yeah, well, it's either one or the other. You know, it can't be good and long. I don't know, Kel. It's just that's experience you need to work on. And I agree. Conciseness is important.
Thank you. I've read a lot of dissertations. And sometimes when I'm reading them, I wonder what the actual purpose was. And I think a lot of people who do those types of papers lose the idea that there's a reason for writing something. And oftentimes, it seems like they're writing it for writing purpose as opposed to actually teach us something that we don't know. I guess it's not really a question, more of a statement. I think anybody who advises students, and there's a number of them here, is I think they need to do a really good job of understanding why they're trying to communicate something, not writing for a writing purpose, I guess is my point.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say, I mean, in some ways, dissertations are trial by fire. That's the hurdle you have to get over, and it's important to document what you do. I'm not against doing that, but by the time a dissertation is meant to make sure the student has been complete and comprehensive, out of that you winnow the papers and presentations to the public, I mean, more than anything else. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. Nowadays, I think there's also the push to say, well, dissertations shouldn't be dusty things that sit on shelves. You ought to write 3 publishable papers and get them out. And that's another, I think that's the way the trend is going. And I'm not against that either. I think that's a good way of doing it. If you've got to write papers anyway, write your papers and just bind them together in a dissertation format. If the graduate school allows that. So.
More questions?
Thanks, Jim. I think probably it occurs to me that part of the problem is that for most of us in the room, 99% of the time, we are not writing or talking to our grandparents. And so our professional experience is almost entirely communicating technically to technical people. And so it seems to me, just listening to your talk, that when we find ourselves in a different situation, talking to a reporter or the public or in a legal setting, that we have to somehow regroup and not just approach that communication the same way we do every day in our work. So it's more of a comment, but yeah. I love your presentations. I think you do a great job, and I never understood the chalk talk thing until you talked about it today, and you do a great job with that. Thanks.
Yeah, I guess I'll comment. One is that even when you're talking to technical audiences, I appreciate when somebody breaks it down to really simple terms for me even. It's still useful, I think, but I agree with you that when you talk to somebody outside the agency techies, to break it down to more simplified terms is difficult, and sometimes I'm not advocating cutting corners, but it's probably they get cut sometimes, and you can't tell as a complicated story in as simplified terms as you would like, and you end up with lake levels being drawn down 4 feet instead of the aquifer head potential being drawn down 4 feet. But it's difficult to get around. I just went to talk just recently, and one of the advice pieces of advice given for talking to the press is you no more than 3 points and make them short, simple, and concise. It's an art. Being at the Science Museum, I've had some exposure trying to keep things non-technical, and it's always a challenge. It always is.
So, Jim, I'm curious about you a little bit. So I imagine there was a time when you figured out that the way you were taught to communicate versus the way that you learned is more effective, where you sort of figured that out.
When did I start to figure that out?
Can you say anything more about that experience? Because what I've seen sometimes in me is when I start to do it a different way, there'll be something inside of me that says, everything, you're doing it wrong. Like the scientific training will kick in and say, you're doing this wrong.
Yeah, that's because
that's not true.
I think in my abstract, I said, when you're a grad student, they put a chip in you that made you always talk in technical terms and you're not allowed to make things simple. You need to deactivate that chip. I think working out at the research station with colleagues out there who are very unpretentious, very bright, Sean Schottler especially out there, he's done a number of presentations that are very off the wall, and they're very effective. And I think working with people like that who are not unafraid to use unorthodox ways of communicating has loosened us all up a little bit out there. I think it's been a very good experience. So I guess I have a peer group that's a support group that's helped do this. So. Point out, I do have a few handouts listing the references I mentioned in the presentation. If you'd like them, and a summary of what I did, so I can like 30 or 40 pieces of paper if anybody wants some. So, yeah,
I'd just like to make a comment on how important it is for the technical people here to reach out to the general public, of which I'm a member. Because as you're speaking there, I have a dim recollection of using an Alban Nigger factoid in front of a legislative hearing 10 years ago. And I think it's important that the general public is part of the process. So thank you for your involvement.
Sure. I'll point out, I have a brother who's been in the natural resources business. There are other Almendinger factoids out there, not just mine. So.